06.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. In February, 30 to 39,000 cubic yards of coal ash were released into the Dan River. The spill was caused by the collapse of a 48-inch storm drain pipe running beneath a Duke Energy containment pond. 27 million gallons of ash pond water waste were also released into the river, which is used for drinking, fishing, and recreation, and which runs into Virginia. In the months since the spill, we have spoken with environmentalists about what the short and long-term impact of the spill might be. We have talked about what coal ash is and why it has been stored for decades in unlined ponds. We've spoken with experts about productive ways to reuse coal ash in building products and in building up the soil for certain projects. But we haven't had the opportunity to talk about coal ash with Duke Energy. And today we will. We're joined by Dave Mitchell and Sean Heath. Mr. Mitchell is Director of Air and Waste Programs for Duke Energy. He's been with the company since 1977 and has taken a supervisory role in environmental issues management at Duke Energy since 1996. Sean Heath is Duke Energy's Vice President of Sustainability. That's a position he has held for 2 years. And to quote his company bio, he is responsible for the company's integrated strategy to operate in a way that is good for people, the planet, and profits. Welcome to you both. Nice to have you here.
Thank you, Mike.
Thanks for stepping into the lion's den on this issue. The EPA struck a deal with Duke Energy to clean up that coal ash spill from the Dan River. What is the status of the cleanup to date? I'm not sure which one of you should answer that question. Dave.
Mike, I can address that. The spill at Dan River occurred on February the 2nd, so that's been about 4 months ago. The early phases of the effort in working very closely with the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the state regulatory agencies from North Carolina and from Virginia was really an emergency response effort. And so we spent about 10 days focused on trying to plug that storm water pipe that you mentioned in the introduction. And that was a very complex project and very much more difficult to do than we initially imagined, but we worked around the clock with the agencies and we got that done.
Duke Energy was surprised, if I recall reading this correctly, by the fact that the pipe that broke was corrugated metal and not concrete or cement or whatever would be more sturdy. Is that because you inherited this plant from Progress Energy?
It has always been a Duke Energy plant.
Oh, okay.
It was
How did you not know about the corrugated pipe?
Well, it was built by Duke Power Company at the time. Mm-hmm. The way the ash basins at Dan River began is they began as a much smaller ash basin. And so the stormwater pipes initially were outside of the ash basin itself. As the ash basins expanded, as the plant operated more over time, the basins cover those stormwater pipes. And so this particular 48-inch stormwater pipe was concrete at either end. So the end of the pipes that we could see were concrete.
Right.
Portion of the pipe that we could not see was corrugated metal.
Could there be other similar pipes under the rest of that coal ash pond or other coal ash ponds in the Duke Power system?
There is another 36-inch stormwater pipe that's under the second pond that we call the secondary pond. Mm-hmm. And so as part of our recovery efforts, we also plug that pipe to assure that there is no possibility of pipe failure.
And when we talk about the cleanup, what exactly are we talking about? Are we talking about taking every single shred of coal ash that seeped into the river off the river bottom, dredging the river bottom and getting rid of it?
Almost initially, our first cleanup effort was focused really just 50 to 100 feet downstream on the Dan River from the pipe break. It was ash that had accumulated on nearby a sandbar mm-hmm. in the river. We got in there very quickly. We were able to clean that up. And then we continued on with working with the state and federal agencies in doing evaluations of the ash in the river, where it was, how much of it there was, and those evaluations continue on. And then even today, we're working on another section of the river doing a much larger cleanup.
And as this, I would think that the current is going to push some of this debris further and further and further downstream. Are you going to continue following its path downstream and taking it out where you find it? Or at some point, does the fact that it's been diluted to a certain point negate the need for that?
You're right. The Dan River is a very high-flowing river. And so it moves very quickly. It moves a lot of sediment downstream. And so in the months since the incident, we have worked in doing a lot of ash surveys within the river. We're primarily focused in the top 6 inches of the sediment of the river because that's where the wildlife and the aquatic life exists. And we've got a very well laid out plan in consultation with the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency and the other agencies on how to survey the river for ash.
Does Duke Energy or the EPA or DENR, the Department of Natural Resources in North Carolina, do they know how wildlife was impacted by this spill? Do they have any die-off of species or certain animals that they know about?
It's really too early to tell the long-term effects. There were no initial impacts that we are aware of. There were no impacts to fish that were identified. We know that there are different aquatic species. There are mussels and other aquatic wildlife in the river. So that's really the purpose of the long-term surveys, is to be able to identify those impacts while we are working today to clean up larger ash deposits that we are aware of.
How long has Duke Energy and other power companies around the country been using coal to generate electricity? It's been a long, long, long time, right?
I think our initial coal-fired power plants were back in the 1920s, so we're talking almost 100 years.
So since the 1920s, have energy companies been storing the waste from burning coal in these open coal pits?
That's a good question. Things have certainly changed over the years. Technology has developed. I think initially when those power plants were constructed and began operation, we didn't have the pollution control equipment available to us that we have today. And so much of the ash went out through the boiler and up the stack at the power plant. And then beginning back in the 1940s and the 1950s, Duke Energy and other companies around the country began installing what we call precipitators, which is just equipment that collects that ash before it's released from the stack. And that's really when we began to use ash ponds, because we were collecting that ash and we needed a means to be able to manage that.
And you're doing that because of environmental regulations that wanted to have cleaner air, correct?
Well, back in the 1940s and the 1950s, that was well before the 1970 Clean Air Act.
So why did you do it before the Clean Air Act?
Well, there were many activities that were going on to improve our generation, to make sure that we were more protective of the environment and our communities.
Okay.
Even prior to the Clean Air Act and the environmental movement beginning in the 1970s.
So this stuff has to go someplace. There are waste products to everything, so it has to go somewhere. So you and other utilities decided to put it eventually in these ponds. Some of these, I understood, were dry ash storage facilities, and some were these wet ash ponds, like the one that leaked into the Dan River. Why is coal ash stored wet, so that the water from that is going to and in unlined pits, so that the water can seep into the ground? Why was that considered to be a good idea, and is it a good idea?
Well, unlined was the technology at the time, mm-hmm. and also wet handling of coal ash was the technology at the time. Dry handling of coal ash didn't come along until much, much later.
Okay, and the reason it was kept wet was so it wouldn't fly away in the wind, or why store it with water, I guess, is my question.
Really three reasons, I think. It's handled wet because that's a means to move the ash out of the power plant. It's also handled wet because that prevents dusting off of the power plant site. And it's also handled wet because that is a means to allow the ash to accumulate and then be able to manage the water that's used to transport that ash to assure that we're protective of the nearby water body.
How big are these ponds?
At Dan River, as I mentioned, we have two ponds. We have a primary pond and then a secondary pond. The primary pond is where the ash first went. It now holds about 1 million tons of coal ash.
Give me an idea what that would be. If we stuck that downtown, if we put it where the stadium is it bigger than the stadium?
If I recall, the primary pond at Dan River is roughly about 40 acres in size. And so I'm not sure how I could quantify that.
And how deep would it be? Just trying to give people an idea of what we're talking about in terms of volume of coal ash.
It varies in depth. It can be on the outer edges of the ash pond. It can be not that deep.
Mm-hmm.
At the center of the ash pond, it can be upwards of 30 or 40 feet deep at Dan River.
So it's deep. And though the Dan River ponds, I understand, that are smaller ponds. So there are much bigger ponds at other facilities.
That's right. Dan River was one of our smaller coal-fired power plants. We used it to generate power when we were up at our power peaks.
Mm-hmm.
We have much larger plants. The Marshall Steam Station, just north of here on Lake Norman, is nearly 20 times the size of the Dan River.
20 times the size. Would it cover all of downtown Charlotte?
It's a Marshall is one of our most efficient, nationally, and was one of the most efficient power plants in the U.S. And so it has generated a lot of electricity, and just with the generation of electricity from coal, it produces a lot of ash.
Yeah.
So it's an interesting picture of the coal ash at Marshall. It runs into a lot of different fingers around that power plant site. And so it's well spread out, not as concentrated as, say, Dan River is.
So Duke Energy and other utilities have been storing these this coal ash in ponds for nearly 100 years in some cases. And in that time, how many problems have there been? How many serious problems have there been? How many problems might there be that you don't know about?
Dan River, I think, was certainly our largest ash release. We have, I think, a strong history of managing our ash basins. We began inspecting those ash basins in the 1970s with an agreement with the North Carolina Public Utilities Commission. We had independent inspections, engineering inspections of the dam stability. And we also have ongoing routine inspections, say, during high rainfall events. So they were well-engineered. They've been routinely inspected. The dams on these ash ponds, the problem at Dan River, as you mentioned, was a stormwater pipe underneath the Dan River, which broke. And so there was no question about dam safety.
But, I mean, have we had other leaks? Have we had other spills? Have we had seepage, significant seepage into the groundwater system from these unlined pits? Could there be problems because of that no one knows about because no one's tested for it, or we simply haven't noticed it in the environment?
I think groundwater is the issue that we're really trying to address today, and that's the important issue. And we have been planning to retire these coal-fired power plants for many years. We've retired over 3,000 megawatts of coal-fired power plants over the last several years. Part of that retirement is not just demolition of the building, but it's also closure of those ash basins. And the closure of the ash basin really is what solves the groundwater issue.
I want to talk about the closure of those basins and what that means, and we'll talk more about the future as we come back here and talk to Duke Energy about coal ash ponds. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Boatsman Gilmore Wagner, certified public accountants helping companies achieve their financial goals with offices in the Charlotte and Huntersville Lake Norman areas. BoatsmanGilmoreWagner.com. Financial fraud in business has existed just about as long as businesses have existed, but the problem of fraud seems to have increased exponentially as business and technology have become more and more complex. No matter the size of a business, the importance of looking for fraud has never been higher, and because of that, there's an increasing need for fraud prevention professionals. We're going to talk about what kinds of fraud are plaguing businesses and find out about efforts to stop it all tomorrow on Charlotte Talks at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm show, the Obama administration proposes strong action on climate change, new limits on carbon dioxide emissions, details of the new rules, and implications for global greenhouse gas levels, coal-fired power plants, and the price of electricity.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking to Duke Energy about coal ash and the coal ash pond spill up on the Dan River and other things with Dave Mitchell, Director of Air and Waste Programs at Duke Energy, and Sean Heath, who's the Vice President of Sustainability there. Dave was just talking about the plans to close some of these coal-fired plants and therefore the coal ash ponds. And in the 2013 Sustainability Report, Sean, it says in March 2014, we, being Duke, shared plans with North Carolina officials regarding our management of coal ash at Dan River and across our system. We propose to move ash at three retired coal plants, accelerate closure at an additional basin, convert to dry fly ash handling at all remaining facilities in North Carolina, and begin dewatering the other retired basins. What does that give us? If you do all of that, what do we gain from that?
Right, Mike, thanks for the question. So we are in the midst of a basin-by-basin review. So for North Carolina, Duke Energy has 33 ash basins. And on a company-wide basis, we have 66. That includes other service areas outside of North Carolina. So the purpose of this review is to really evaluate, using science and fact, what is the most appropriate environmental solution for each basin. Mm-hmm. And there are a number of options, and Dave can provide some line of sight into the different proposals that we may come forward with by the end of the year. But the desire really, Mike, is for us to be in a position this year where we can demonstrate to North Carolina customers, here is our plan. Here is our plan for closing all of our basins in the state across the seven retired coal-fired facilities that we have and the seven facilities that are still in service today.
We've been told that by the EPA that coal ash is not classified as a toxic substance. It is not classified as a toxic substance. Duke Energy has, I think, said everything is fine. And in the sustainability report, you report that after the spill on the Dan River, downstream drinking water remained safe during the incident, and environmental monitoring teams from multiple agencies and Duke Energy continued to track river conditions. If it's safe, if it's not toxic, why close them? Why clean it up? Why the hurry?
Well, Mike, you're right. Coal ash is a non-hazardous substance. But I think certainly in the Dan River, that's a place where ash is not supposed to be. And it's not according to the way we've handled ash previously. And so our efforts to survey the river and to make removal of the ash where we can is important to help assure the health, future health of the river and the use of the river for the community. I think you're right in mentioning groundwater. That's the main point of our efforts to plan for and hopefully soon be able to close the ash basins, especially.
But if it's safe, if there's nothing in it, if it's not toxic according to the Environmental Protection Agency, why do we care if it seeps into the groundwater?
There are groundwater standards at the federal level and also at different states, and so those standards are established to protect drinking water. And we began monitoring groundwater around our ash basins on a voluntary basis under the rules in North Carolina and the other states that we operate in. And we've identified, through information we've routinely provided to the agencies, exceedances of some of the groundwater standards. Iron and manganese have been primary exceedances, which can be naturally occurring in the Piedmont area of the Carolinas. And so we want to close the ash basins to assure that, one, we get the water out of there, that we're able to manage the ash carefully, two, that we are helping to mitigate any impacts to the groundwater, and that we're able to potentially use those sites for a future generation or other needs.
Heavy metals do come out. Heavy metals are in coal. So when you burn the coal ash, it seems to me that whatever doesn't burn up is concentrated in the coal ash, and there are heavy metals in the coal ash, are there not? And substances like arsenic in the coal ash, are there not?
The majority of coal ash
What's in the coal ash is a good question to start with, I guess.
Well, the majority of coal ash, about 90%, are common materials like silica, I think, as Dr. John Daniels talked about. You also have some minor elements like potassium that are roughly 8% of coal ash. And then the metals that you talked about, the trace metals like arsenic and selenium and mercury, comprise less than 1% of the total volume of coal ash.
Because Sarah emails, I live on a mountain island lake and recently attended Duke Energy's neighborhood meeting about coal ash. Their representatives told me the arsenic in coal ash is nothing to worry about. He said, coal ash is made up of the same stuff that's in my multivitamin. He almost made it sound good for me. However, when I came home and did some research, I learned that not all arsenic is the same. There's a big difference in organic, naturally occurring arsenic, and inorganic, the kind in coal ash arsenic. Organic arsenic doesn't cause cancer, but inorganic arsenic is a known carcinogen. Is that a concern?
Arsenic and the other metals, purpose of us closing the ash basins is to assure that concentrations of those metals don't get any higher than they already are. And in the majority of our power plants, groundwater sampling has not identified those metals. It's mostly been iron and manganese. Now, some of the heavier metals have been identified in some samples at some plants. And so part of our closure plan is to be able to mitigate any of those locations.
We had some scientists and some researchers on from UNC Charlotte a couple of weeks ago to talk about alternative uses for coal ash, what to do with it other than just put it in these unlined wet pits. And they left me, at least, with the impression that coal ash is benign. It's fairly benign. I mean, you don't want to sprinkle it on your breakfast cereal in the morning, but, you know, it's not going to hurt you that badly, and that's why they can use it in enriching soil for embankments and things like that. But if it's fairly benign, I don't understand why everybody's scurrying around trying to get rid of it. How can it be both benign and scary enough to let's get rid of this stuff before we have a lawsuit? And there are lawsuits.
It's benign based on the way that it's handled. And so recycling or reuse of coal ash is a primary objective of Duke Energy and other companies. We recycle about 60% of the ash that we generate. Much of that ash goes into the concrete and the cement industry. It's included in other products that are manufactured. And then other good uses of coal ash are what are called lined structural fills, such as the one that we have underway at the Asheville Airport and the one that we're talking to the Charlotte City Council about potentially performing it at the Charlotte Airport.
Hasn't that been shot down? Hasn't the airport rejected that idea?
The due diligence period continues to run with the city staff. We've been engaged with them, answering many of their questions. We've been working with our contractor, Chara, who's based out of Kentucky and has got a lot of experience in managing coal ash. And Duke Energy has worked with the company for many years. We have a lot of trust in them. So due diligence continues.
Did their initial rejection of reusing coal ash, and I think what they wanted to do was put it under runways and they wanted to build up embankments, amend the soil with the coal ash and build up embankments. Did their rejection of that surprise you? And in your mind, is that a wise decision? Was it unnecessary, an unnecessary decision?
That point was initially raised by the Charlotte City Council in our discussions with them. So that's a question, a primary question that's come out that we have worked on. Coal ash is used as a structural fill under roadways, under other airport runways. That's a very good application. Coal ash compacts very well, sometimes even better than soil, and so it forms a good road base.
But if we're worried about groundwater seepage of coal ash from these ponds, if you put it under a roadbed, aren't we just spreading it all over the place and causing potential even worse ground? In other words, it's not the groundwater seepage would not be concentrated in one pond, it'd be all over the place.
What you've done, Mike, in that application is you've capped the coal ash. You've put a road over the top, you've put an airport runway, you've put a large parking lot. And so what you're doing is you're preventing rainwater from moving down through the ash. And so there are no impacts to groundwater based on those types of applications, and they've been done over many years around the country.
Here's a question that puzzles a lot of people about, and we probably didn't think very much about it until the spill on the Dan River, but a lot of these coal ash ponds that Duke Energy has and that other power companies scattered around the country have are located near bodies of water, many of which supply drinking water to millions of people, and that's certainly the case at the Marshall plant up here in Charlotte. Why have these wet pond storage ponds been located near bodies of water where it could leak into the water?
Well, that's where the power plants are, as a fundamental question, and Sean, you may be able to elaborate on that.
Sure. Power plants are typically built near water for cooling purposes.
Right.
And if you think about a nuclear power plant or a coal-fired generation facility as well, water is used to generate steam, which is then used and converted into electricity.
Mm-hmm.
So the location of the plants has really dictated to some degree the location of the basins.
How often do you test the water around these ponds and the groundwater around these ponds? How often do you test and how do you test?
We do two primary tests. One is a test of our permitted discharge from the ash pond to the water body, say to the lake or to the river, and we have a permit for that. That data is reported to the state routinely. We also have groundwater monitoring wells that were installed, as I mentioned, initially voluntarily, and then over time were required by the state agencies. And in North Carolina, we test them three times a year and report that data to the state as public information.
And as you test, have you found anything that should be concerning? And does it fluctuate from time to time?
It does fluctuate. Our readings when we initially install the wells are usually higher, just because in installing the well, we've kind of churned up the soil and the ground. What we found in many cases is those readings drop off and drop off fairly significantly, oftentimes where some of our initial readings are not detectable by laboratories.
Charlotte is allegedly the coal ash capital of the country. Is that true in your mind? And the reason I say that is because we have four of 44 EPA high-hazard ponds within a 29-mile span of river.
Duke Energy last year, I think, produced about 40% of its generation from coal. And so one thing that Duke Energy has planned for and been known for is having a diverse fuel mix. So we have nuclear, we have hydro, we have gas, we have renewables. And so coal is part of our mix, and it's helpful to our customers in keeping their price down. The pond ratings really have nothing to do with the condition of the ponds. The condition of the ponds has been shown by many inspections to be in very good shape. What the rating does is it assigns a rating as if there were a break in the pond and ash were released. What could it impact? Could it impact the water body? Could it impact local neighbors? And so that's how the rating was assigned.
Well, as you said, we have 20 times more coal ash in a pond at the Marshall plant than we have at the Dan River plant, and almost a million more people drinking water from the waterways around that plant than they have on the Dan River. And Beth in Belmont writes, I'm concerned about the 450,000 tons, if that figure is accurate, of coal ash that have been buried in Belmont near Lake Wylie. This coal ash is not on Duke's disclosure list. There are homes currently being built near this site, and people don't seem to know about it. How far away should homes be built from a burial site like this, and why is this site not on Duke's official disclosure list?
That sounds like a structural fill where we sold coal ash to a third party and they used it to fill in a piece of property for commercial or other development. When you do that kind of work, it's permitted by the state agency. Depending on the permit, they have different setback restrictions from water bodies, from wetlands, from drinking water. And so as a permitted structural fill placement, those concerns would have been addressed in the permit. And so that's not Duke Energy ash. It was sold to a third party.
But these coal ash ponds on the Catawba River and around Lake Wylie, Lake Norman, and Mountain Island Lake, which is where Charlotte gets most of its drinking water. The Duke Energy corporate headquarters is right down the street. You guys live here. What would happen if we had a spill like we had at Dan River on our river?
I think you've asked what if. I think the important point about Dan River is that it was a break in a stormwater pipe. And so we have employed independent third-party engineers. We've initiated and initially completed a review of all of our ash basin dams in our territories in all of our states. One, to look at their engineering construction, to review the ash ponds themselves. And besides Dan River, we only identified one other power plant in Indiana that had stormwater pipes under the ash basin, which we are
addressing.
Is that
the only way we could have a catastrophic leak? It could not be a breach or if we had an earthquake or if we had some sort of, I don't know, a gargantuan amount of rain? Because these are open pits, right?
That's right.
So could if we had an amazing amount of rain, could there be an overflow situation where the effluent would flow into a river? Is it possible?
If I could just interject with one point back to this
sure.
analysis that we're in the midst of, because these are important what-if questions, mm-hmm. right? So a big piece of this analysis will be an evaluation of, for a particular basin, for a particular ash pond, what is the most appropriate environmental solution given the specific profile for that location? Mm-hmm. So you start asking questions about orientation of the basin relative to the groundwater plane. You start asking questions related to the ability of a basin to withstand a high water event, a flooding type scenario. You ask about the proximity of a particular basin to drinking water mm-hmm. sources, drinking water reservoirs and water intake. So those are the very types of questions that our team of engineers and technical experts are just now evaluating.
So just now?
Well, I should say in the midst of a comprehensive review, which will be completed this calendar year.
So how would you feel if we had a spill like we had on the Dan River into Mountain Island Lake?
I think as part of Sean's point, these ponds have existed all the way back into the 1950s. And so we've had extremely large rainfall events during that period. As we're many of us are talking about, it's an anniversary for Hugo, which mm-hmm. was the major hurricane that came through the area.
Right.
So these ponds have been in existence through all kinds of rain and other weather-related events. They've been inspected routinely. We have different equipment located at the dams to assure that we can monitor for any kind of movement. They were originally designed for seismic conditions, so they were well designed. They've been inspected by EPA, by the state, by Duke Energy, and the condition of the dams have been shown to be in very good condition.
As you close these coal ash ponds, what do you do with the coal ash? On the program that we did with the folks from UNC Charlotte, we got some information about how long it would take to empty just one of these ponds. It was an alarmingly a large amount of time, and we'll share that with folks when we come back from the break. I got to take a break. We're talking to Duke Energy here about coal ash, and then we're going to talk about sustainable electric generation power. Is it a pipe dream, or is it in the future? Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Actors Theater, presenting Passing Strange, loaded with soulful lyrics and overflowing with passion. This is a rock show with a message, Thursday to the 28th, details at atcharlotte.com. Yesterday, the Obama administration announced sweeping changes on CO2 emissions that may, if passed, may impact all kinds of things, including the air we breathe and the price we pay for electricity. We'll be talking about that in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show. If you'd like to join our conversation, WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks is a great place to start, or Facebook or Twitter, and we are coming right back.
Saturday and Sunday mornings on WFAE, we bring you the week's news, but we might also take you along on an alligator hunt.
So right now we're in the flooded forest, and there's a bunch of cypress trees around with Spanish moss looking for the alligator snout, but right now it's just real flat.
News, conversations, and the unexpected. Weekend mornings from 8 to 10. It's Weekend Edition on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Dave Mitchell is with us, Director of Air and Waste Programs for Duke Energy, and Sean Heath, Vice President for Sustainability. You've been talking about having plans in place to start removing coal ash from these wet ponds and getting rid of it, and I'm just wondering what you're going to do with it. Paul Newton, who is Duke's North Carolina President of Operations, said that it would take 2 years to excavate and remove coal ash from the Dan River site, which is the company's smallest coal ash pond, and 30 years to excavate and remove coal ash from Charlotte's Marshall plant. That means there's an enormous amount of coal ash out there. What would you do with it? Where will it go?
Mike, there are two primary methods to close an ash pond. One is to cap it in place. So we would drain all the water out of the ash pond.
Where will the water go?
The water would be normally released through our permitted discharge, so it would be monitored, and we would assure that we don't exceed any of our permit requirements.
I mean, do you clean the water first? Do you, or do you just put it into the supply that will eventually be our drinking water and expect the utility company to clean the water from that point on?
It's how it's handled now and how the power plant has operated for all those decades. It was with a permitted discharge, and the permit is issued by the state regulatory agency, and it assures the health of the environment and also public health. So those limits in our monitoring requirements are there to assure the health of the water body.
Okay, so you would drain the water.
And then we would normally consolidate the ash, and then we would put a cap over the top of it, so that we have a synthetic barrier that assures that no rainwater goes down through the ash. It would have a soil and vegetated cover, grass, that's maintained. And then we would monitor through groundwater monitoring for upwards of 30 years to assure that we see improvements in the groundwater and no further impacts to groundwater.
Are you still using online, when you build a new, I'm not sure you've built any new ones, but when you build a new coal ash pond, are they unlined or are they lined now?
The very newest coal ponds are lined, but there are very few of them. Most of our ash ponds go back many decades.
Why weren't they just made out of, why didn't you build these ponds like a swimming pool with a concrete base?
That was the technology at the time. Going back, again, Dan River initially had its ash pond built in the 1950s.
So we've done a program on what alternative uses for coal ash, particularly in construction products. And David on Facebook writes, inventor and philosopher Buckminster Fuller said, pollution is nothing but the resources we are not harvesting. We allow them to disperse because we've been ignorant of their value. Do you think you might have a gold mine in coal ash if you can convince manufacturers of concrete and other substances to essentially encapsulate it in that concrete and other substances?
Well, reuse has been a very high use for us, and we have reused about 60% of our ash historically, which pretty much saturates the market, the construction market for concrete and other materials. So besides capping the ash pond, the other method of closure is what we call excavate and remove. And as Sean mentioned, I think you alluded to, that's what we've committed to do at River Bend and also at Dan River. We've estimated the cost of excavating all the ash from our Sutton Power plant. And at Asheville, we continue to haul that ash to the Asheville Airport. So that would be removing all of the ash from the ash basin there at the power plant to either a lined structural fill or a lined landfill and move it away to another location.
There are more than a few lawsuits pending targeting Duke coal-fired plants and coal ash ponds, but I understand that Duke is resisting changing the way you handle the ash as a result of those ponds. Is that true, and if so, why?
We constantly change the way that we handle coal ash based on the technology that's available to us. I would say with the litigation, we're cooperating with that litigation, and we look forward to seeing that the litigation process develops to a successful conclusion.
In one lawsuit, Diener, the Department of Natural Resources here in North Carolina, is suing Duke for the ash seeping out of a pond. And in another, where an environmental group is suing the Environmental Management Commission, Duke is an intervener in that case and has appealed the judge's decision, which says the company must stop the seepages immediately. Why are you appealing the decision?
Immediately cease is a very specific term in the groundwater regulation in North Carolina. That rule was written many years ago. We're understanding from the agency it didn't contemplate ash ponds, that it was written for leaking underground storage tanks and other small spills. And so immediately cease is really up to the regulatory agency. Agencies from the federal to the state level are granted deferral on how they interpret their regulation, and the interpretation of that section of the regulation was reinforced over many years and recently reinforced by the Environmental Management Commission, which is the rulemaking body in North Carolina.
Were it not for Duke Energy, were it not for electricity, we would be having this we probably wouldn't be having this conversation, but if we were having it, we'd be sitting on the square with megaphones yelling because there would be nothing to power these microphones or the radios that people are using to listen to us on. You're the Chief Sustainability Officer for Duke, Sean Heath. Can Duke produce the amount of electricity that we consumers now require to run our toasters and our computers and our TVs and all of our gizmos without coal?
Without coal. Well, just a little bit of historical context. So if you think about Duke Energy in 2005 compared to 2013, our carbon emissions have decreased by 20%. In a very intentional way. So we're closing a 10-year fleet modernization program, a big part of which has been the retirement of many of these older coal-fired power plants. You know, Dave mentioned that we've been burning coal here in North Carolina since the 1920s, and many of these older coal-fired power plants, the youngest of those plants were in the baby boomer generation, and they're now being retired. So as a company, we have continued to decarbonize our fleet. At the same time, I'd say coal has been a valuable resource in the state of North Carolina.
But I know that you're trying to open what are called clean coal plants. Is that decarbonizing the fleet?
Well, you know, clean coal, of course, is in the eye of the beholder.
Right.
If you were to look at the coal plants that we have in operation today, they're much more efficient than the previous generation of coal-fired facilities.
But as you close a coal plant, why replace it with another coal plant, whether you call it clean coal or not, whether you believe it's clean coal or not, why not replace it with something else? Can we generate enough electricity to meet demand without coal? Can Duke Energy become, over time, a sustainable power company?
Well, in my view, we are a sustainable power company today. We have a very diverse mix of fuel sources here in the Carolinas. Of course, we rely on nuclear, coal, natural gas, energy efficiency, and renewable energy to a larger extent. I know we have some stakeholders that would like to see us move even faster. I would argue Duke Energy has been a leader in the area of emissions reduction.
It's part of the problem that a lot of people don't like coal-fired power plants. Other people don't like nuclear power plants. Other people don't want those darn windmills anywhere near their line of sight. And we are in a great place in North Carolina for wind power off the coast, but they don't want the windmills. Is that part of the problem? You can't have everything.
It is a challenge, and every fuel source at our disposal has pros and cons. And similar to an investment portfolio where there's relevance to diversification, that's the same way we think about our fleet of power plants. And it's one reason why in North Carolina our customers have benefited from very affordable, very reliable power since 1904.
Is that because of coal or is that because of water power?
Well, it's yes and yes. North Carolina is situated in a region of the country where we have the ability to bring all of these resources to bear in our energy mix.
Water becomes more scarce and as Duke has to become even more careful about how it manages the water supply in Lake Norman and Lake Wylie, are we going to have to depend less on those hydroelectric generators?
No, I think that, you know, the hydroelectric generation that we have in place today is here for the long haul. But if you look at our fleet and the technologies that we have in place today, you know, water consumption, water supply is always a consideration for us in long-term planning considerations, both where we site power plants and how we operate power plants and how we convene groups of other water consumers in the region.
If we began closing these old coal plants, and if you didn't build replacement clean coal plants, what would that do to the price of electricity?
Sure. Well, if you think about the way utility makes decisions in terms of meeting the needs of its customers, it's a very sophisticated resource planning analysis, which is an attempt to look into the future and make assumptions related to load growth within our service area, as well as different price points, the economics, and the fuel supply associated with different resources. And if you look at what we've done most recently in the Carolinas, we've primarily brought natural gas combined cycle assets into our fleet. Of course, we did have Cliffside Unit 6 brought into the fold in 2012. That was the first new coal-fired unit in North Carolina for Legacy Duke Energy since 1976. So because of natural gas prices, we have seen a shift from coal to natural gas in recent years. But we're burning less coal now.
Is natural gas going down in price because of fracking?
So shale gas, of course, you know, the ability to tap into shale gas has had a very meaningful impact on the price point for natural
gas.
And
there are lots of people who are not happy with the idea of fracking. So this is another instance of because of what it does potentially to the groundwater. So I guess the question I'm asking, all of these, except for hydro, and wind and solar, all of these have downsides.
I think, as I'd said before, every resource has pros and cons, and we're very supportive of...
What's the con on solar?
Well, so we're very supportive of solar and wind. So we've invested over $3 billion in bringing those businesses into the fold at Duke Energy over the last few years. With renewables, one of the biggest challenges, of course, is intermittency. So with a solar facility or with a wind-powered facility, they tell us when they're running. Unlike a coal-fired power plant or nuclear facility where we dispatch those plants based on our needs and based on economics. So, you know, as we look out into the future, we continue to believe that renewable energy will play a larger and larger role in our energy mix. There's no question about
that. Duke was the number two producer of new solar installations last year in the country?
Well, in terms of installed solar capacity, North Carolina is in the top five.
And you plan to double your solar footprint by the end of 2015, which is just down the road, by adding 300, I think it's megawatts, is that
correct,
right?
Correct.
But that is less, 300 megawatts is less than a small coal plant produces. And the
correct.
Company has told the Utility Commission in your most recent long-range plan that 15 years from now, solar will still make up only a tiny fraction of your mix. Would it be possible to add more solar, more wind to the mix? Would it be possible? And if it is possible, why? What's holding that back?
Sure. So for context, of course, this is a system that was over 100 years in the making. And if you were to look at Duke Energy, Progress Energy in North Carolina prior to 2007, there was really very little renewable energy to speak of on the system.
Mm-hmm.
So policymakers in 2007, along with the environmental community, electric suppliers like Duke and Progress, and customer organizations in the state that all have a vested interest in this topic, came together and put together a renewable portfolio standard, basically a mandate for the state of North Carolina, where electric suppliers like Duke Energy are required to provide power using qualified renewable energy resources for a certain percentage of our energy delivery. And it's important to keep in mind, we're still on the very front end of that compliance trajectory.
Mm-hmm.
So the ultimate requirement is 12.5% of our retail sales by the year 2021 will need to be derived from renewable energy resources and energy efficiency measures.
So why is Duke Energy, I believe Duke Energy, is opposed to the federal and state government extending tax credits for solar energy providers? Is that true?
I'm not aware of us being opposed per se.
Are you opposed or not opposed to the Utility Commission requiring you to pay rooftop solar owners less money?
Oh, I see what you're referring to. So there is an emerging debate, and this is really a national debate, and it will play out in North Carolina at some point in the future, focused on what we call net metering. So in a nutshell, very quickly, net metering is if a residential consumer were to put solar panels on their rooftop.
Mm-hmm.
In those instances, in those times during the day where they are not using all of the solar power produced by those panels, that excess power is put back onto the grid, to
right,
our grid.
Right.
And currently we pay our full retail rate to those customers for any power that they put back on the grid. And we believe that there will be a time in the near future to have a good, honest debate around what is the true value of net metering, what is the value of distributed generation that's put back onto our grid, and what is the fair price for us
to
pay those
consumers. Isn't the fair price what you're charging me as a customer? In other words, if I'm generating electricity in excess of what I need and I give it to you, why isn't my price to you the same as your price to me?
Fair question. So consider that the price that, we charge our customers is based on our full cost of service. So our full cost of service includes not just the price, not just the economics of producing power, but also the cost of delivering power over transmission lines and distribution lines and serving customers.
So you have overhead.
It's the full gamut of the utility operations, whereas a solar customer with panels on their rooftop is a power producer, not a power deliverer.
I have, and they're going to do a whole program on this in 5 minutes, but yesterday the Obama administration announced one of the strongest actions ever taken by the government to fight climate change. How will this impact Duke Energy and coal power? And I have 30 seconds.
It's too soon to say. It'll take 2 years for this process to play out.
Okay.
To the point I made earlier, Duke Energy, we've been planning for this future for quite some time. Exactly what the requirements will be, it's too soon to say. The states will be given a fair amount of flexibility to develop their own plans.
And who pays for the cleanup on the Dan River? Customers or shareholders?
We've been very clear that the cleanup efforts related to the Dan River incident itself will be paid by shareholders.
Sean Heath is Vice President of Sustainability. Dave Mitchell is Director of Air and Waste Programs, both with Duke Energy. Thanks for the hour. Appreciate it.
Thank you.